Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Hindu Studies. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balgaran. You can send me comments, questions, requests at raj@rajfalkran.com. Today I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Alexander Rocklin, who is at Audubon University in Columbus, Ohio. We are speaking on his book that you've probably already heard about, The Regulation of Religion and the Making of Hinduism in Colonial Trinidad. Consider this part two of the Caribbean Studies interview. Hello, Alex, and welcome to the program.
Well, thanks so much for having me. I would note, you know, we are recording this during the quarantine in 2020, and so I hope people out there listening are staying safe, staying inside, and listening to the New Books Network.
Indeed. It's not a surprise that I did say, so in 2019, I think I did about 22 interviews. In April, I think you're my sixth or seventh.
Right.
April of this year. And yeah. So part of that, my workflow hasn't changed too much because I'm a bit of a recluse who works out of home. Of course, my mindset has changed a lot. But this is sort of my way to fight the war effort, to give people folks to listen to something at home.
Yeah. Well, it's valiant work.
Yeah. So... I'm not going to go too much into the genesis of your project because I imagine most of the listeners will have already or soon will listen to part one with Alejandra Bronfman in Caribbean Studies. But there's so much fascinating material that obviously pertains to Hindu studies that we had you back on here. Actually, full disclosure, there was interest in learning more about Hinduism in the Caribbean and the West Indies. We had a couple of podcasts that talked about the Hindu diaspora recently. Suzanne Newcomb's Yoga in Britain and I think it was Pankaj Jain's Dharma in America where folks were really interested in whoa, there've been quote unquote Hindus in the New World for over a century.
Yeah.
And so I reached out to Alex and he was happy to oblige and actually put on my radar that he'd already been interviewed for New Books Network. But we figured, you know, there's no shortage of material in the book. If you had to tell us the main, just to give us a focal point for this interview, the main theme question, the axis mundi of your book, what are you really interested in here?
Yeah, I mean, I guess one of the things that really kind of drew me in was, you know, how do people become religious, right? If this, you know, one of the things, even from when I was an undergrad, this idea that was kind of percolating that really kind of caught my interest was this idea that religion is not a natural category, that it is imposed through processes of colonization, European colonization, along with a constellation of other categories, like, for instance, race. And so then how then do people get religion, right? And so one of the driving questions as I was thinking about the project, as I was doing my research in Trinidad, in 2011 for the longest stretch, was like, how do people who don't have religion gain access to religious freedom, right? How do you kind of begin to shape your understanding of the world and how you live in it in order to gain access to a set of privileges that are afforded only to practices that are put underneath this category? And for indentured laborers, Indian indentured laborers in Trinidad, this was a really important set of issues, right? Because otherwise, when they were under their labor contracts, they really couldn't leave the plantation very often. And religion was one of the few excuses for doing so.
So there's a number of fascinating points you touch on there. And there's sort of two kernels that I think really worth unpacking, particularly for an educated public who may or may not have the background. The first pertains to religion and the extent to which religion may well be viewed as a construct. I want to ask you about that. I also want to ask you about, how has there been Hindus practicing in the West Indies and Trinidad, Guyana, for example, for all this time? Folks are really interested. I mean, a lot of people don't really know the backstory of that. So the reason I pose both questions is because I'll leave it up to you as to which one you'd like to tackle first.
Yeah, I mean, I guess for your second question, as to the kind of general background, right? Indians were after the end of slavery in the British Empire, Indians came to the Caribbean as indentured laborers. So basically, there was this outcry among the white planter class that because they didn't have slaves any longer, they were going to go bankrupt, and they wouldn't get people to work for them. Which was, I think historians have made the argument, was rather exaggerated. But so because of this this pressure from planters, the British worked to set up this indentured labor scheme, bringing Indians from all over India to the Caribbean. They also ended up going to South Africa, to Fiji, and within the Caribbean, they're in the kind of broader Greater Caribbean Basin. So in parts of South America, including Guyana, and Indians were entering into labor contracts not only in British colonies but also ultimately in colonies in the Dutch in Dutch colonies in French colonies as well. So that's how Indians end up in the Caribbean in the first place. And in kind of thinking then about the idea of Hinduism itself and kind of where this emerges, the kind of other side to that is the category Hindu. And so when the indentured labor scheme begins in the 1830s, I think the first indentured laborers go to Mauritius in the Indian Ocean in 1835, and you have the first Indians arriving in Guyana in 1838. And in this period, Hindu is, for the most part, a regional category and an ethno-racial category. So if somebody was Hindu, for the most part, it meant somebody who was from India. And so that then leads to the kind of complexities of how the category of religion can kind of be operationalized in this context, and how, in the title of the book, how Hinduism gets made. Part of that involves a transformation of this category Hindu.
So one might be inclined to think that religion is one of the most powerful and pervasive forces on the planet. And so one might be intrigued at your claim, which is obviously not solely your claim, that, well, this is sort of an invented category. I think at one point you invoke Daisy Smith to say, well, you know, religion is basically a function of the scholar's imagination. Unpack what you mean for that in terms of the discipline, so folks understand. When you say that religion is an invention, what is it that you mean by that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think the idea that religion is not a natural category, that it's kind of emerges through religion as we know it today, emerges through processes of colonization and racialization, right? So it's European empires begin to spread around the world, beginning in the 15th century, you have then along with this process of the emergence of modern categories of religion as well as race and other categories. And so it's this kind of moment of, I think probably in many ways for Europeans, attempting to kind of to compare, you know, what they think of as quote unquote religion, kind of capital R religion, which is Christianity, to all these other kinds of practices that these other groups of people who they are engaging with, who they are attempting to conquer, how they can compare those practices to what they're doing. And, you know, I was very much influenced by the work of Tomoko Masuzawa in her invention of world religions, right? That this kind of gradually over the course of centuries and really kind of beginning to crystallize in the 19th century, when my book kind of begins, you have then the kind of formation of this idea that, well, there are these, you have the concept of religion as a kind of separate and separable sphere of life. And then you have the emergence of the notion of world religions, which is that there are these religions, which are kind of things in the world that exist out there, and they are separate and separable, and they're defined by a sincere belief. They're defined by a text or set of texts. And so when I began to look at the evidence for what the kind of social lives of indentured laborers was like, when the indentured labor scheme begins in Trinidad, I really didn't see evidence for something called Hinduism, right? So one of the other fundamental arguments that I make in the book is that Hinduism was not something that was brought from India to Trinidad on the boat. Like people were able to, for instance, bring, you know, texts, like you could bring a copy of the Ramayana from India to Trinidad, but you couldn't bring Hinduism. That's something that really only emerges as a kind of a broader collective identity and social formation, really beginning in the early 20th century. And so I see these kind of the emergence of religion in many ways kind of precedes Hinduism, right? That indentured laborers have this idea of that they have religion kind of imposed on them, and then they very much incorporate this concept and use it for their own purposes before Hinduism itself becomes a self-evident way of kind of identifying and dividing up practices and groups of people.
Yeah, it's sort of always struck me that the extent to which religion defies ready definition or categorization, that principle is exasperated or perhaps best exemplified in Hinduism. Mm-hmm. Among the religions, it seems to be the case that what's happening on the globe among practices that we call world religions is happening almost as densely within the South Asian subcontinent. Mm-hmm. So you talk about this in your other interview, but it's worth mentioning here. What do you look at? You're looking at a particular point in history, and what sort of documents are you looking at? What data are you looking at for your work?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I for the longest stretch, I was in Trinidad for about 10 months and spent 2 months then in London. And I was primarily working in archives, in the National Archives in Port of Spain, as well as in the special collections at the University of the West Indies in St. Augustine. And a lot of the material I'm looking at are either colonial documents, so documents produced by colonial officials. There were kind of reports. The protector of the indentured laborers was this kind of official who was responsible for making sure that the interests of indentured laborers were being protected. So those kinds of reports from jails, official reports from other kinds of institutions, hospitals, but also then kind of unofficial reports from missionaries, which I think we could also include among these kind of colonial documents. And then the other major source are newspaper articles. The vast majority of indentured laborers were not able to get education, and so they weren't producing their own. They weren't producing their own texts for the most part. So in newspaper reports, occasionally, you know, reporters would either interview or there's evidence that they were talking to indentured laborers, oftentimes probably through a translator. Occasionally there are also petitions that are written by Indians as well, which sometimes can be in official reports, but also were sometimes sent to newspapers too. So primarily I was doing archival work. I also did some participant observation. I did interviews at a mosque with an imam, oral history interviews, as well as did some work with a spiritual Baptist doctor, and also spent a little bit of time at a Hindu temple as well.
So what are the specific strands or tributaries, threads, sort of these religious traditions that we can now discern in Trinidad?
In Trinidad now?
Both now and maybe primarily in terms of the period you're looking at. What are the different tributaries? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that really kind of began to emerge for me as I was looking at the material is that there were early on, you know, by the kind of mid-late 19th century, say in the beginning of the 1870s, but even before then, you had for subalterns, generally speaking, a set of kind of ritual events on a shared calendar where seemingly people would come together. And again, in this period, Hinduism isn't a widespread collective identity or social formation. So the people who are coming together to engage in ritual practices were from across what we would think of today as kind of the world religion. So you'd have people who today we would call Hindus or Muslims or Christians, and it was people of Indian descent as well as people of African descent too. And also at times, you know, people of Chinese descent or other folks. And they were doing things like firewalking, which was a tradition that in Trinidad is identified as being specifically South Indian or Madrasi. Oftentimes done for goddesses like Mariamman or Kali or Draupadi. They were doing things like summoning spirits of the dead or kind of dealing with spirits of the dead, which is a whole kind of diverse set of traditions that was at the time and still today referred to as Obia, although practitioners don't really call it Obia. Ram Lila was another important ritual event that was on kind of a shared calendar among subalterns, which was the dramatization of the narrative of the Ramayana, and also Muharram or Hussein, which is the commemoration of the martyrdom of Imams Hussein and Hassan, or the grandsons of the Prophet Muhammad, and that was particularly important for indentured laborers in the 19th and early 20th century, because that was actually the only day that indentured laborers, or is actually 2 days that they got off from work that were specifically quote unquote Indian holidays. So they had like Christmas off and they had race day off, and they weren't supposed to work on Sundays, but the Indian holiday was actually Muharram. And so that was a really, I think probably in the 19th century, one of the most important and kind of long standing ritual thread. And those kind of, I think for many people, those ran together as the kind of structure, the way in which their years were structured, certainly while they were in, while they're working on plantations. And it's really only in the early 20th century, probably really most significantly by the 1920s, that these get kind of disarticulated and are bundled together so that it's now not like kind of separate ritual complexes, but it's, you know, these people are Hindus and they do Hinduism and they only do Hindu stuff, and these people are Christians and they only do Christian stuff. I think one of the things I try and trace are the way that these kind of threads are tangled up, and then they're untangled and they're retangled again in different kinds of kind of ritual formations that eventually become something like, you know, the world religions.
Who's doing the tangling, do you see, and why are they doing it?
I think part of, maybe to kind of clarify what I mean by tangling, using your metaphor, one of the things that's kind of happening is that, you know, indentured laborers are thrown together with one another on plantations. And I think one of the things that causes this process of tangling, we could say, is the imposition of the category religion itself, that Indians are gradually beginning to understand their world in terms of religion and not religion, that they're kind of gradually seeing that this category is an important way of dividing up the world in this colony. And so what they kind of begin to understand that the way that people come together and how they're come together and when they're allowed to come together really very much depends on this category that's imposed on them by the British and very much in many ways defined by British, for the most part, Protestant assumptions about kind of what religion is supposed to look like. And so I think those are kind of the moments when Indians are particularly trying to get off plantations in order to engage in these various rituals throughout the calendar year, are the moments when they're engaging in the discourse on religion. I think, you know, barring a category from David Chittister, I talk about the colonial comparative religion, and I specifically talk about the way that subaltern comparative religion, the way that subalterns are using this category in order to authorize, for instance, leaving a plantation in order to take a model of the tomb of the Prophet Muhammad's grandson Hussein on a public road in order to take it to the ocean or to a river. And when the government when police officials try and stop them, they can say, no, this is our religion. I think kind of those are the moments, I think probably for the most part, things are not particularly tangled. And those are the moments when things get tangled up, when people are forced to kind of think and speak reflexively about religion itself, kind of to reflect on what it is they're doing, and do this discursive work to kind of fit their practices into the set of norms for religion that the British have imposed on the colony in a significant way.
And so there's a number of examples I think you use in your book, but can you maybe dive into how this categorization was used by the British, or in terms of the utility of manufacturing religion in this way?
Utility for the British. It shows up in different kinds of ways. I think one of the kind of obvious ones is the category of obeah, which is this kind of, it's a term used in the British Caribbean and the Anglophone Caribbean today that means something like black magic or witchcraft, and it's usually defined kind of popularly as being kind of African magic. And so one of the ways that the British were able to stigmatize non-normative practices, or to stigmatize oftentimes violence on plantations, was to say that it was the result of obeah. And oftentimes also when people of Indian descent were engaging in non-normative practices, oftentimes in the context of their homes, and doing so as a in order to do things like engage in the managing of spirits of the dead or engaging in healing practices, in doing so, they're able to make money outside of the context of the plantation system. They become again targeted as practitioners of obeah, and so oftentimes when they end up in court, the people who are being charged with obeah have a tendency when I look at descriptions in newspapers to say, you know, what I'm doing is religion, right? I am a pundit, I'm a Hindu priest. And what I'm doing is religion. And then the police and the judge and the case will say, well, no, you're doing obeah. Because, you know, obviously this isn't, you're not doing proper religion, because if you're a Hindu and you're having, you know, people of African descent come to you who are Christian and you're, you know, dealing with ghosts, in relationship to them. It's oftentimes what is revealed then is this moments of back and forth where the British try and categorize as something as not religion, and the kind of response from Indo-Trinidadians is to say, you know, no, this is my religion, and therefore you have to respect it, right? Because one of the things that's one of the few freedoms that Indians are given is that they have the guarantee of freedom of religion, to certain respects. And so this gives a kind of weight to the category of religion for indentured laborers and other folks too.
So in terms of the stigmatization of opia that you talk about, would you say that the British powers, would you say they produce the stigmatization or create it, or would you say rather that they leverage an existing stigmatization of practices such as opia?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think in some ways they're leveraging it, right? I mean, I think the kinds of practices that are called obeah, or, you know, another example is something like firewalking, right? There were in the late 19th and early 20th century, you know, Indo-Trinidadians who would have seen something like firewalking or people doing what people would call obeah, would see that as being, you know, superstition or as being, you know, ritually problematic even. Something like both firewalking or obia may involve, for instance, things like animal sacrifice, which somebody who was, for instance, identifying as high caste may see as troublesome, as problematic. And so there were certain kinds of debates among Indo and Afro-Trinidadians themselves about kind of what proper ritual practice involved, what was true and efficacious, what was kind of morally positively valued and what wasn't. And that itself was, obviously in certain kinds of ways influenced by British assumptions as well. But I think it's a kind of ongoing, and it was an ongoing and cyclical process. That's what I would say.
So do you want to tell us a little bit about, reform movements that emerge from within natives of Trinidad at that point? Mm.
Yeah, I mean, I think, so one of the things I kind of talk about in the book is that the first part of the book is about kind of religion and how religion gets imposed and Indo, but also Indo-Trinidadians are kind of adapting this category of religion for their own purposes. And the second part of the book, in many ways, kind of looks then at the emergence of Hinduism, which only kind of happens after religion gets in many ways naturalized, I think, for folks on the island. And so that the process of the emergence of Hinduism, I think, very much involves this kind of attempts to reform practice. And that's probably, in many ways spurred by the arrival of missionaries from the Arya Samaj, from India, beginning in the 19-teens. But really, this kind of project of reform broadly really picks up in the 1920s when you have this more concerted kind of quote-unquote orthodox Hindu reaction to the reforms that the Arya Samaj are trying to put in place. So the Arya Samaj, right, is a reform movement from the 19th century in India, which was trying to kind of as they saw it, bring Hindus back to the kind of true religion of India, the Vedas. And so what the Arya Samaj missionaries brought with them to Trinidad was a critique of certain kinds of caste distinctions. There was critiques of the use of images in worship, critiques of animal sacrifice. And those critiques in certain kinds of ways also lined up with British assumptions about what proper religion ought to be too. Trinidadian Hindus who heard these kinds of critiques coming both from Arya Samaj missionaries who were educated, who were literate, and who were coming in and kind of telling them what was what, and hearing certain different kinds, but similar kinds of critiques from, for instance, Protestant missionaries who were Canadian Protestant missionaries, for instance, in the south of the island. There was this kind of move among an emerging middle class beginning in the 1920s to kind of incorporate those critiques coming from both Christian and also Arya Samaj missionaries, but also to kind of push back against them and say, you know, we have our kind of true original orthodox Hinduism, which is not this modern, quote unquote, modern reform movement. And so you have then in the late 1920s and early 1930s, the emergence of what were kind of Sanatantaram movements. And the use of Sanatantaram here is a kind of an attempt to try and translate, I mean, in many ways, Hinduism as a kind of term to incorporate that concept as Hinduism as a world religion in order to create these social formations that could bring in Hindus and try and kind of create Hinduism as a kind of world religion in contradistinction to Christianity, as well as the critiques of the Arya Samaj, as well as, you know, reacting to also Muslim missionaries and Muslim movements on the island too.
In terms of this this epoch of reform, of reformation within the Hindu world, which is really, one can argue easily, probably was also a formation, right? That one can possibly craft the argument that there is no Hinduism without Hindu reform. That Hindu reform is actually the impetus of defining and articulating and trying to grapple with naming something as vast as what we now call Hinduism. Now, during this epoch of reformation and formation within the Hindu world, what is different? What is unique? Why does it have a different traction, perhaps, in this context? So if you have these, just use the example of the Arya Samaj movement missionaries, you know, what's different about what they are doing or not doing or able to do in this context versus if they were in somewhere in South Asia?
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that sets off Trinidad in terms of these different kinds of debates and process of reform, and as you say, kind of formation and how these traditions are being invented and are emerging. In the context of Trinidad, you have, I mean, first of all, it's a small place, but then also you have kind of tight government control. You have certainly in the early in the early 19-teens, people are still, to some degree, indentured laborers. And then you also have a significant population of people of African descent, too. So, for instance, the Arya Samaj, in doing their work, were, for the most part, speaking to Indo-Trinidadians, but there were also converts from Afro-Trinidadians, too, who were changing their names and becoming, members of the Arya Samaj. And so I think, you know, there's a different kind of ritual field. There's a different different set of histories that lead to different sets of concerns in terms of how this process of reform and also kind of the formation of Hinduism end up being formulated. I think in a significant way too.
So regarding your initial question or your research query about how people arrive at or come to religion in general and perhaps Hinduism in particular, what do you find? What are your findings? What do you answer? How do you answer the question you set out to?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that I was particularly interested to note and to trace in the book was this kind of gradual process of the kind of crystallization of the quote unquote world religions, right? The way in which religions themselves are emerging as what we're seeing as very much separate and separable kind of watertight entities. This trend towards exclusivity, which increased. And I think very much in Trinidad today, as you know, historically in India too, these things that we think of as world religions, were not and still are not kind of mutually exclusive. There's all kinds of complexity and overlap between them. But I think one of the things that I was interested to note was the way in which, as Hinduism is emerging, even before Hinduism becomes a more widespread collective identity in Trinidad, you have this move towards exclusivity. So for instance, the Christian missionaries. The Mortons were missionaries who were working in the south of Trinidad, and they talk about how when they first started in the late 19th century, that it was very common for Indians, just to kind of come to church and check it out and participate. And they weren't there necessarily to convert, but they were there. They would, whether they were engaging in making offerings to goddesses, or whether they were, going to a mosque or what have you, they would still go to church and they would kind of do this together. And by the 19 teens, you gradually have this kind of process of people stopping doing that. And by the 1920s and 1930s, you have kind of this move to try and among Indo-Trinidadians to try and kind of make religions kind of separate and separable and more exclusive entities. So for instance, one of the things that I trace is the emergence of the first kind of Hindu organization is the Sanatan Dharma Association, which the first members of that association were, many of them were Christian. And there's this kind of moment of outrage among some Indian Trinidadian elites who specifically are identifying as Hindu, that there could be kind of members of an organization, a Hindu organization, and including the president of that organization, were identified as Christian. So kind of part of that process of exclusivity or trying to create exclusive world religions is a process also of trying to make not only kind of separate and separable world religions, but also making separate and separable racial groups too. So trying to stop Afro-Trinidadians from kind of loosely participating in these kinds of events, stopping Muslims and Christians from participating loosely in Hindu events, and sort of making sure that everybody is either Hindu or they've kind of gone through a conversion process in order to make sure that kind of Hinduism, the borders of Hinduism, are appropriately policed.
Were the missionaries successful in this context?
Well, which missionaries are we talking about?
The Christian missionaries.
Christian missionaries. So the Christian missionaries were unsuccessful in that the vast majority of Indians did not convert to Christianity. But at the same time, they were very successful in that many Indians end up getting education from Christian institutions. There's some secular schooling, but for the most part, schools are religiously affiliated, and early on, they're exclusively Christian, either Catholic or Protestant. And so if Indians wanted to get an education, and also they wanted to get a leg up, if they were, if you wanted to get a job, if they wanted to get a job in within a school, for instance, being a teacher was a very good position. They had to at least, nominally be Christian. So those who did convert very often did so, I imagine probably for all kinds of reasons, but one of the things that was gained was access to certain kinds of Christian privileges, things like a job. But again, very often, I think, really, certainly through the early 20th century, even if people were converting, that still didn't mean that they weren't, making offerings to Kali or Shiva or, participating in Muharram or Hosei. And it's only really kind of only gradually that it becomes the case that people are kind of assuming that if you become a Christian, then you do Christian stuff and you don't do Hindu stuff. So that's one of the things that kind of gets debated in this period of reform, particularly in the 30s and 40s. So although I would say in some ways, although the missionaries are unsuccessful in converting a lot of people, right, the kinds of things that missionaries were able to offer, even if people don't convert, are still really valued. So people are getting a Christian education. And through that process, even if they're not converting, they're very much incorporating kind of elite Protestant assumptions about what religion is like into their lives. And so I think that's one of the things that I track in the first part of the book is this process of the imposition of the category of religion. And one of the ways that happens is through a kind of Christianization, that even if people aren't becoming Christian, they're becoming kind of Christianized in a certain kind of way. Or I talk about it as kind of secularized in a way too, because from an elite perspective, kind of true religion or appropriate religion looks like Christianity, and particularly elite Protestant Christianity. And so those processes are very much interlinked. So that kind of how we count success in conversion, people may not be calling themselves Christian, but the kinds of assumptions and expectations about religion generally that both missionaries and colonial officials had become imposed and are incorporated and redeployed by indentured laborers and their descendants in really significant ways.
You preempted what I wanted to ask about next, which was this idea of secularization. No, it's a good thing. You talk about the category of religion, and implicit in that is the idea of secularism. Yes, and so you more or less said it in a nutshell, I think, just now, talking about the relationship between religion, Christianity, and secularism. But I think it's really worth diving into. And what comes to mind is that so much of what you're seeing in this time and space of colonial Trinidad and the aftermath is sort of as if you could magnify what's happening in various other parts of the globe in a very concentrated, manageable way. And so I think it, obviously things are different in this context than elsewhere, but at the same time, I think you're seeing overt concentrations of what's happening throughout the colonial world at this time. Mm-hmm. So anyhow, aside from this random airy-fairy insight, I was going to ask you about the relationship between Christianity, religion, Protestantism, and this notion of secularism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think to your comment, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, I think one of the things that I found really fascinating about Trinidad was the way in which, because so many Indians who were brought in were indentured laborers and were oftentimes indentured for up to 10 years. They're under close colonial scrutiny, kind of from colonial officials as well as from their dependents, including plantation owners and then their people who are working on plantations. And so I think in some ways that I think you're right, very much it kind of accelerates these processes. And I think to segue to your question, I think one of those processes is this process of secularization, right? And so I think there is a kind of there's a way in which kind of missionization, education, and secularization are all interlinked with one another in the context of Trinidad. And so that's one of the ways in which I'm trying to trace the way in which people are becoming religious, that the ways in which the category of religion itself is becoming naturalized in this context. And so there are a whole series of institutions in Trinidad that are very much doing the work of, we could say, kind of secularizing the indentured laborers, right? They're doing this, they're, accelerating this process of imposing and naturalizing this idea that religion is a separate and separable sphere of life. And that religion is, meant to look like elite Protestant Christianity in a significant way. Right, that it's meant to be segregated off, that it's meant to be contemplative, that it's meant to be private, and what that meant significantly for expectations for laborers was that laborers would during the week, Monday through Saturday, do their work, not kind of buck the trend, make sure that they are making money for the people who they're indentured to, and then on Sunday they can quietly and contemplatively, worship their gods or whatever, as long as colonial officials don't need to see it.
they can contemplatively sacrifice a goat to Mother Kali.
Yeah. Well, so that's where, you know, things kind of butt up against each other, right? So where the kinds of affective connections, the particular histories of relationships with gods and goddesses that Indians are bringing with them to Trinidad, in many ways, oftentimes don't line up with British assumptions about what true religion ought to look like. And so that kind of, those are the moments that I was interested in part because those are the moments that oftentimes show up, right? I mean, the moments when people are kind of quietly, you know, saying a quiet prayer to Kali, the British don't care about that, right? It's when they're out on the streets walking on hot coals and somebody's, you know, sacrificing a rooster. Those are the moments when the police are stepping in and saying, you know, you're disrupting the flow of traffic to, you know, those stores over there or whatever. And so in some ways the hope of British officials, as well as, you know, Protestant missionaries and so on, was that in getting indentured laborers into the system, they would gradually get them, you know, I don't know that they expected them to convert to Christianity, but what they hoped is that they would be incorporating this set of norms for religion that were very much reflective of elite Protestant Christianity. And so in doing, they would then become better workers, that they would be spending their times during the week working and, you know, on Sunday doing whatever they needed to do. And so kind of keeping the worldly work and the otherworldly religion separate would make better laborers in a significant way. And so things like, you know, the jails, schools, orphanages, a whole array of colonial institutions were linked up and were doing this kind of work of inculcating this particular understanding about what religion was as belief or faith, as private, as kind of quiet or quietist in a significant way.
So was there anything that really surprised you about your journey writing this book? Did you overarchingly sort of dive into and clarify and confirm what you may have suspected, or were you really thrown for a loop?
Mm. Yeah, I guess I've been sitting with the material for so long now that it's hard to remember what was surprising and what wasn't. But I mean, I think I came into the project with a set of kind of broad questions that emerged from work that I had done in doing research in religion in India. And so there were certain kinds of things that were maybe unsurprising in looking at Trinidad, because there are certain kinds of ways in which it is, in looking at history of, we could say, Indian religions in Trinidad, you know, it's very much reflective of what you see in India in certain kinds of ways, but at the same time, doesn't look like you wouldn't necessarily find any of that, although it looks similar in India itself. And at the same time, the kinds of theoretical questions that I was interested in, particularly the relationship between kind of colonial knowledge production and the imposition of the category of religion. Having looked at India, was not entirely surprised at what I was seeing in Trinidad, but at the same time, I think, as you were saying, it was very much kind of concentrated in a different kind of way, that, you know, it becomes a kind of microcosm where things are speeded up and intensified. And so I think one of the interesting things that I found in beginning to look at this material was the way in which even early on, you had people who were coming from impoverished backgrounds who didn't have kind of formal educations, very much kind of incorporating this the category of religion and kind of using it for their own purposes, in ways that probably you didn't see in large swaths of India, where, you know, in the mid to late 19th century, you know, people probably weren't necessarily butting up against colonial officials in significant kinds of ways, oftentimes. So one of the things that I was kind of interested in thinking about the work I had read previously on these kinds of questions as being asked in you know, of the context of India was that oftentimes those works were focused on the on kind of elites. And so I was very much interested in kind of understanding the way in which kind of these, you know, heterogeneous groups of people who were, for the most part, coming from poor backgrounds, who were not educated, were doing similar kinds of work to what, you know, elites in India were doing too. So that was one of the things that I found kind of interesting and surprising. And that very much kind of drove then the kind of stuff I was focusing on in looking at the archives.
So then what next? Where do you go from here?
So I'm working on an article looking at accusations of madness connected to Afro-Trinidadian or Afro-Caribbean religions, looking at Trinidad, but also St. Vincent and other contexts. Kind of the thinking about kind of the discourse on disability and madness in Afro-Atlantic religions. And then I have a book project, which I hopefully will also be able to advance over the summer, looking at a variety of different kind of case studies of people in the Americas from the kind of early 19th to mid 20th century who identify as Hindu in different kinds of ways. So people of Indian descent, people of African descent, people of European descent, who are calling themselves Hindu or doing stage magic, who are doing kind of what we could think of as practical magic, who were traveling around, who were getting in trouble. I'm looking at sort of oftentimes these people become visible because they're on trial for obeah or on trial for fraud in the U.S. And I'm looking at these examples particularly to think about the, on the one hand, the history of the category Hindu and how it's been variously kind of imagined and repurposed in different contexts around the Americas, and particularly the way in which it has been used and has been seriously contested as both an ethno-racial and also a religious category. And then using that particular history to think about, broadly the ways in which the categories, religion and race, have been variously entangled in, and what the potential implications of those are for the study of religion, generally.
It certainly seems to be a passion of yours. The definition, the identification with Hinduism and what that means in terms of various practices, various philosophies, various prejudices, various ethnic or nationalistic concerns. And so unsurprisingly, that that passion is continuing to power your work, because you may not be able to exhaust it after 10 books.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. Yeah, definitely.
But so then you'll have to return to the program when your next fascinating Hindu studies work is out.
Well, yeah, I would love to.
Well, you've already had two interviews. Why not make it three? So I think we've taken enough of your time for today. For those of you listening, we've been speaking with Dr. Alexander Rocklin of Otterbein University in Columbus, Ohio, on his 2019 publication, The Regulation of Religion and the Making of Hinduism in Colonial Trinidad. And in case you're listening on a regular basis, no, you did not imagine the other interview. There was another interview. This is part two. hopefully focusing on various other topics. Was there anything else that you hope to touch on in this follow-up interview?
No, I think that's probably more or less it.
Wonderful. Thank you very much for joining us today. And until next time, for those of you out there, keep reading, keep listening, stay safe in these transformative times. Take care.